If you're an avid football or cycling fan, you've probably heard this voice.
A club's characteristics can change massively. It's not like, you know, it's so certain clubs have a certain vibe, have a certain feeling. You know, Valencia is a great case in point. You know,
right.
When I was working in football, I used to love going to see matches at this. The Mestalla, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. No, this is not Peter Drury. This is his voice twin, Ned Bolting. He is a former football commentator turned cycling fanatic. He is also the author of 8 books. That's right, 8 books. Everything from his life to football to cycling to even darts.
I think if there is a club near you, that's where it starts, and that's how football should still operate, really. I think it's quite unique as a sport like that.
In today's episode, we talked about how he fell out of love with football after a 20-year commentating career.
I've been doing sports broadcasting for 25 years, as mad as that sounds, it's true. And for 20 of those years, I mean, maybe that's an exaggeration. Let's say 15 of those years, I was slowly, without even noticing it at first, but I was slowly falling out of love with football, which was a game that I'd adored.
We also talked about some of his most memorable moments, like interviews with Jose Mourinho and having beers with Arsene Wenger.
Possibly the most arrogant man I've ever met.
Really?
Yeah, really. Like, really. That's not like
breaking news.
but in such a fascinating way. He would go through all this classic kind of power play things with you. Like you learned after a while that you didn't put your hand out to shake hands with Jose Mourinho because you risk just being left hanging. You know, like that, the hand wouldn't come back.
You're listening to Bored with Nelly.
Ned, I'm a big fan of, first of all, your commentating career, which I have no idea how many hours I've probably listened to without even knowing some of your football matches.
Yeah, I guess so.
I wonder if there's like a average number, like the average football fan has heard your voice. They might not even realize it how many times they've.
Yeah. You've got to be careful. You've got to be careful with that because you may think you've heard my voice, and I'm sure you have. But I also have like a voice twin who I'm always being mistaken for, and he's always being mistaken for me. And he is much more, well, I'm not involved in football anymore, really. And Peter really is. So Peter Drury, a lot of people, he commentates in the UK for Sky Sports. And I think he used to commentate in North America as well on various channels over there. But he sounds a lot like me, apparently. And he's a good friend of mine as well. So that's pretty weird. So maybe you've heard a bit of Peter going on there as well.
He actually does. And I was watching football maybe a few weeks ago and I heard the voice. I'm like, wait. Didn't he retire like 10 years ago? Is he back for one? He's not back for a Brentford game, surely. Come on.
Yeah. So you're a big football fan. You're a football fan.
Big football fan. I live here in Valencia. I watch a lot of their games. I'm still an avid fan, but I'm a fan of everything. This podcast is a general podcast. I invite all kinds of people from all kinds of walks of life.
Sure.
So I had a question, I guess. In the book, you mentioned your father having a football gene, I believe, and you talked about how you don't necessarily didn't inherit that at the start.
Yeah, and it wasn't so. My dad grew up as in the post-war years in London, and for various complicated, quite strange reasons, actually, his family became Chelsea fans, and he definitely kind of bought into that as a kid, and as a young man, he was a season ticket holder. And there, you know, if you know your London football, Chelsea have not always been this kind of money bags club that they are now, ever since the Russian guy got involved 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And stuff. You know, back then they were incredibly glamorous, but quite ineffectual. You know, they weren't ever very good, really. But they always had this, because of where they're located in Chelsea, they had this kind of incredible glamour that was attached. But we didn't grow up, you know. My dad, when he had a family, he left London, and we grew up in the provinces and nowhere near a professional football club. So my dad sort of tried to instill this love for Chelsea that he'd grown up with onto me. But for one reason or another, it didn't click. And even if it had done, you know, I think you have to support the team that is nearest to you when you're growing up. I think that's how it works. I know not everybody does that, and there's lots of kind of Manchester United fans in Hong Kong.
Right.
But I think if there is a club near you, that's where it starts, and that's how football should still operate, really. I think it's quite unique as a sport like that.
Are you a purist in the sense that you cannot support two clubs? This is a fun one. So I always talk about this one with football friends. Like, is it okay to support?
I think so. But then you've got to define your terms. You know, there are degrees of supporting a club. And if you are a club's supporter, then I think that if you support a club, I am a so-and-so supporter. I think that is a kind of like really deep level of commitment. And you don't trade that. That's with you. Once you've decided that, that's for life. Right. And you don't abandon them when they get relegated, and you don't lose interest in them. That's a pact. That's sealed for the rest of your life. But I think you can have, alongside that and in tandem with that, I think you can have soft spots for clubs. You can have a kind of mild affection for clubs. Obviously, they can't be the rivals of the club that you support. But they can relate to maybe, you know, we all live very different lives nowadays to maybe when our parents were older, where you kind of like grow up and stay in the same place.
Right.
We tend to sort of like move around the world a little bit, don't we? You certainly have. Yeah. You know, wherever life takes you, I think you can make new discoveries, and you can have a soft spot for Valencia.
It's like an Erasmus, you know. It's like a
yeah.
Intercambio here. It's like an exchange. You know, I come here and I learn a bit about the culture, about the. I mean, it's in a weird way, like when you go into a football stadium, and even if you're not a supporter of a club, you feel something in there, which is like the combined 60,000 people that have that passion. And I don't know about you, but I get like teared up a little bit, or like watery eyed when I hear a local chant, or I see people screaming for their club. I don't have to necessarily be a fan of the club, but I can feel what it means to someone else, and that immediately makes me more intrigued.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's right. But it's not just, you know, like a club's characteristics can change massively. It's not like, you know, so certain clubs have a certain vibe, have a certain feeling. You know, Valencia is a great case in point. You know,
right.
When I was working in football, I used to love going to see matches at this. In the Mestalla, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
I used to love going there. That had a very particular vibe, as do Benfica and certain clubs. But Athletic Bilbao is an amazing institution.
Right.
But, you know, things can happen to clubs that kind of move them from one cultural position to another so dramatically that actually they're unrecognizable. And I think Chelsea's pretty close to being that to some extent. And I think the ultimate example of that is Manchester City, which, I mean, I do not know how, for want of a better word, legacy Manchester City fans, people who were there supporting them 20 sure. years ago when they were two divisions lower, and bankrupt. What I do not understand how or why they feel any affinity with the Abu Dhabi franchise that is now Manchester City. They've moved from their historical homeland in South Manchester to East Manchester to this rather soulless, unimpressive modern stadium, and they're owned by Abu Dhabi. And as far as I'm concerned, the crest is the only thing that remains, but it's an empty symbol. And I think that I think that club has ceased to exist.
I think it just says what our society is about today, and jumping on the latest or the most popular thing. You know, I think it's a much bigger topic, not just a football topic. I think it's a culture and society topic. I look at the other scenario, which is I am originally from Serbia. I was born in Serbia.
My
parents are both Serbian. My club is Red Star Belgrade. What's happened to Manchester City and Chelsea is the inverse of what happened to Red Star Belgrade.
Right.
Once a European giant.
Yeah.
When my dad describes to me these events that he used to go to as a kid, like 100,000 people in Belgrade watching Barcelona versus Red Star Belgrade or Real Madrid coming to visit or Liverpool, it doesn't even make sense. I cannot put this scenario in my mind that this happened in the exact same stadium. Nothing changed. Everything is in the exact same spot. But it's almost like two worlds apart.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, but that says a lot about, you know, that Red Star were a great club when? In the 80s? Early 80s?
Champions League winners in 91.
Oh, it was as late as that? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still pretty good in the mid-90s. I mean, the Balkan War has really destroyed that whole region, but they were a giant in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, the European football landscape was so different, wasn't it? You get, you know, 10 years before that, you had Nottingham Forest winning the same, you know, the European Cup 2 years in a row. You know, it's kind of unimaginable now, isn't it? You know, and it's a cartel, it's a closed.
Sure.
You know, even really big, powerful clubs historically, like Ajax or you know, some of the Italian clubs that have fallen on lean times, like Juventus.
Yes.
I mean, a massive name. Juventus are a million miles away from ever winning the European Cup again.
Right. Right.
You know, it's just like it's
I mean, look at all the money PSG has spent, and they still have not been able to replicate what just a golden generation of people from Yugoslavia or some region, in, you know, smaller region in the world, was able to do in the 80s, 90s, 70s. It's kind of remarkable if you think about it.
I'm really comfortable with that, you see, because I'm very fond of France. I spend a lot of my working life in France. As we may go on to discuss, I don't know. I commentate every July on the Tour de France, and France is a country I feel very at home in. But I resent deeply the fact that the French produce generation after generation these wonderful football teams, the national teams, and they keep winning major tournaments, and they're brilliant at what they do. I resent that deeply because France is not a football nation. Not really, not deep down. It's paper thin, really. The number of big clubs in France are like three: Olympique Marseille, Lyon, and PSG.
Right, historically speaking.
PSG,
I mean, not even in that long to history. History, I mean, PSG not that long.
Exactly, but I find it very amusing that they can't actually get over the line, and you know, despite throwing money at the problem. But you know, if you just look at the two capital cities, Paris and London, you know. Paris has got two stadia, you know, the Parc des Princes and the Stade de France. London has got the Tottenham, it's got the Emirates, it's got Wembley, it's got Twickenham for rugby, it's got Stamford Bridge. You know, it's just sports mad. And, you know, and then you go down, it's got Loftus Road, it's got Craven Cottage, it's got Selhurst Park. Down it's got the Valley for Charlton Athletic, it's got Millwall's Ground.
West Ham Stadium.
I haven't even mentioned the Olympic Stadium. It's absolutely
But the other stadium, the West Ham, the
Upton Park, the old one.
Yes, Upton Park. I mean, iconic.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. So anyway, I'm very comfortable with the French struggling because they can't have everything. They can't have they can't have invented the greatest sporting event on earth, which is the Tour de France. They can't have that, the greatest bike race and the greatest cultural sporting juggernaut in the world in the Tour de France, and also be the best football country in the world. That's not fair. They've got to decide one way or another, you know. So,
if I may interject, have you been to the French Open?
What, tennis?
Yes.
No, I haven't.
Okay, I'm sure, you know, I know you love cycling, but if you have time to ever go, the French Open is a beautiful event. It's like Disneyland for tennis fans. And even if you're not a tennis fan, the atmosphere of an entire facility built just for tennis, and it's a very unique thing because it's an entire facility that only is used twice for 2 weeks a year.
Yeah.
And then it just sits there. Does nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's something to be said about like the atmosphere of tennis and the spectacle of tennis and what it's become, especially in the last decade with Nadal, Djokovic. But it's a beautiful event. I would strongly recommend it.
Yeah, I don't know much about tennis. I was asked on a podcast that I host relatively recently by our listeners, which sport that you've never commentated on would you quite like to commentate on? And I thought about it for a bit and I thought, actually, I think tennis would be quite easy.
Yeah.
Because it's obvious what's happening. Sure. You've got no problem identifying the players, right? There's only two of them. And also you don't really have to say very much because by and large you let the action speak for itself. So it's like
it's quiet in between points. It's not gentlemanly in your talk.
Don't say anything, you know. And in a really long rally, you don't have to say anything for about 2 minutes. And then the ball will fly into the net and all you have to say is, oh, good heavens.
Oh, dear. A blunder of that.
Yeah. So I thought that'd be quite funny. And then, ironically, no sooner had I decided that tennis would be a sport that I'd quite like to commentate on that I was offered a job very recently, actually. I went out to Madrid. Oh, I think I told you I was in Spain.
Next time you're over here, let me know, please. Like, I love
it. I will do. I was in Madrid for a week commentating on a sport that's very big in Spain, but not really anywhere else, called paddle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I say Spain, it's in the Spanish speaking world. So it's really big in South America as well. In Argentina, it's very big. And there is a kind of like growing sense that actually it's, I think they claim it's the fastest growing sport in the world, and that one day it'll kind of break out of its Spanish language box that it's in.
Yeah.
I went over to commentate on that, and I thought that would be quite relaxing and a bit like tennis, but actually it was just 13 hours of shouting. Like, it
might be harder than tennis. I think that might be a harder gig than tennis.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more going on because it's doubles for a start, and it's like really intense, the pace of it. And it's a bit like, I suppose the best comparison is that paddle is to tennis what pool is to snooker.
Interesting. Okay.
Right. So tennis and snooker have got this kind of very sedate, slightly genteel, historical kind of pace about it. And pool is a slightly more, a slightly more user-friendly and accessible version of snooker, isn't it? Like, it's easier for you and me to play pool than it is for you and me to play snooker.
Absolutely.
The holes are bigger, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's easier to play paddle than it is to play tennis. So there's a kind of a similar dynamic going on there anyway.
You've had a long football commentating career, and it's now it sounds like you're just, are you just having fun looking for other things to do? I mean, obviously cycling is your new passion and obsession.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What else are you kind of looking to achieve and do? Because I imagine commentating is such a rare job. If you really think about it, there's maybe a couple hundred people on the planet that are, you know, doing it.
Yeah, it's pretty niche. It's a strange way to earn.
You're more niche than comedians.
I guess so. I earn a living, but my life's a strange mixture of things. Really, I mean, I divide my working year into three parts. Really, in the summer, by and large, I tend to commentate. You know, through the spring and summer, that's mostly what I do for TV. But I spend my winters writing. You know, I've written 7 or 8 books. Not all about cycling, one about football, the one that you've alluded to, another book about dart, another book about the sport of dart.
Didn't get a chance of that one, but that one looks fun. I'm going to give it a listen.
It's a book I'm immensely proud of, actually. And so I write a lot, and I do a lot of other writing for various different outlets. That gives me a great deal of satisfaction. And the other thing I do is every other year, and this is where it crosses with Bilal Zafar's occupation, I know, as a friend of yours, is I tour one-man shows about sport, about the Tour de France, actually. I'm working on so I do this kind of one-man show and take it around the United Kingdom and visit theatres and do about 25 gigs like that. So I have a rather odd bespoke career that juggles about 3 different things that kind of overlap a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's fun. It's fun.
You did a little bit of comedy when you were younger, and it was in Germany. Has that helped you in your speaking career?
Deep down, I was a frustrated comedian, I suppose. So it's kind of nice now that with the one man show, I get to go on stage, and you know, the idea is that I make people laugh. You know, like, I don't want people to come and pay for a ticket and then sit there in glum rows of silence. You know, like, it's designed to be fun. So it's kind of cool. It's cool fun. I enjoy it.
Isn't there an interesting difference between the book and when I listen, especially to your audiobooks, it's like I'm in a kind of in a trance and I'm listening to your thought process and I'm just a passenger. But in a show, you can't really do that. You have to kind of keep the crowd engaged. So you're creating a different style. You're still probably writing out a lot of your presentation, maybe key points.
Yeah.
Is there a
yeah.
big difference between the writing of the book and then the writing to the tour and the presentation and stuff like that?
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, when you're writing a book, you have in mind who your reader might be, but the reader is a very distant figment of your imagination, really. And it's weirdly, it's not that dissimilar when you're broadcasting, you know, kind of like commentating on TV. You know, I can't see my audience, can I? I have a notion of who they might be, and that, you know, sometimes there's a million people listening in, but I kind of ignore that, because if you stopped and thought about that for too long, you'd freeze, really. Whereas when you're standing on stage live, to a large extent, the audience is in control. You know, they will determine whether or not you're going to enjoy yourself for that night, you know. And you get a sense of it quite early on, you know, within the first minute or so, you'll have prepared some fresh jokes for the evening and kind of like, and then you'll hit a regular point where you kind of, where you've, you know, you've got quite a good joke lined up after about 30 seconds and you'll drop it in. And that's always a kind of like really telling moment, because if it doesn't go great, you're kind of thinking, okay.
All right.
This could be a long couple of hours now. This could be intense. And there's a huge difference between performing to a Friday night or Saturday night crowd or a Monday night or Tuesday night crowd. There's absolutely night and day. It's such a difference.
Have you ever bombed in front of a big crowd? Or that's the expression, I guess.
No, I don't think I have bombed, because I'm fortunate, really. I think that people who come and see my shows kind of know who I am and cut me a bit of slack. They also know that I'm not a professional comedian. So they're kind of, I'm really lucky, they're sort of on my side, you know. So unlike Bill Allen people who have to go into, you know, often open mic nights or just bunches, you know, like it can be quite hostile.
Yeah,
they've got to win them over. Like, I don't have to do that. Thank God, because I would not cope well with that. That's a whole different world of brave, I think.
I mean, I'm thinking about this as well, bravery and switching. This is the one, I would say, part I would find very relatable with your story, as crazy as it might seem. I not only moved to Spain from Canada, but I also switched careers. I actually have a electrical engineering background, and I switched into content creation, digital marketing. So a complete unrelated career.
Yeah.
You, after many years of football commentary, decided to go into cycling, although commentary still completely different.
Yeah.
So a few questions around that is, one, when did you kind of realize that you just didn't want to be doing this, or you were kind of going through the motions?
So, yeah. Well, to deal with that, I mean, it was a slow, gradual process over probably 20 years. Like, I've been doing sports broadcasting for 25 years, as mad as that sounds, it's true. And for 20 of those years, I mean, maybe that's an exaggeration. Let's say 15 of those years, I was slowly, without even noticing it at first, but I was slowly falling out of love with football, which was a game that I'd adored, which is the reason why I ended up doing what I did. You know, I fell in love with the sport, but then exposure right up close to the actual nature of the game led me eventually to become very disenchanted with it, I think. And there's something particularly unpleasant about, I mean, thank God, I kind of got out of it maybe 7 or 8 years ago, actually, completely. And I think in the intervening 7 or 8 years, I think the social media world around football has kind of only got more and more bitter. You are doing a job on the TV, often, you know, a big match, you know, it can be like a Champions League semi-final or a Champions League final involving a British club, and you're there with the microphone asking the players on behalf of the viewer the kind of key question, and millions of people watching at home think they can do your job better than what you're doing it, and they kind of and they will let you know in no uncertain terms. You can't, there are very few broadcasters in football who inspire kind of universal admiration, respect and love of the viewing public. Most are lampooned and sort of detested.
At some point you become a villain. It doesn't really matter when.
Yeah, you kind of like, and particularly because football is so tribal, you know, if you say a word, if you make a comment or phrase a question to a manager of a club, that will be taken by the fans of that club in a particular way that you never intended and was never really, but you can't win, you know, and it's a pretty toxic environment. And behind the scenes, you know, in the bowels of a football stadium when a team has just lost and the manager has to come out and face the press, you know, there's a lot going on just to the side of the cameras that is out of shot that you never see, doesn't make the television pictures. But there are people who are like pulling you in all sorts of directions, who are tearing strips off you for the impertinence of your line of questioning after the red light has gone off, you know. Managers will, you know, hold grudges and vendettas against journalists that last decades sometimes. You know, it is a it's a toxic environment with a few notable exceptions. It breeds, I think there's so much at stake in terms of the money. You know, you can have a fantastic career as a football manager. You can get a contract, you know, in the Premier League for a couple of years and basically you're made for life financially. Yeah. You know, there's a lot at stake here and it's not funny. And everybody within the game has forgotten, by and large, that it's a game.
Yeah, it's so serious now. Everything,
you know, it's just a massive business. And I didn't. I grew very much out of love with that.
What was the last commentary day like? Quitting and kind of not doing it again. How'd that feel?
Yeah. Pretty liberating, actually.
Really? Yeah, like quitting a bad job.
yeah. I mean, it was a combination of factors. But when I realised that's probably the last match I've ever done, I kind of had a bit of a skip in my step, and I thought, do you know what? Now I can actually go home. I can carry on doing professional work. I can do jobs that actually I want to do, and I don't feel like I'm doing with a heavy heart. And the real reward was, I thought, that I can actually, now I've exited the game, if you like, I can start to enjoy it again in the same simple way that I used to enjoy it before I started working for TV, you know.
So you went back to Germany and went to watch football?
Simply experience it as a punter, right. as a supporter, as a fan of the game.
Sure.
Without feeling like every time that particular player picked up the ball, I know him, and I remember the last time. You know, like I know what he's really about. You know, right. Like and like. Thankfully, there are no players left. Really, I mean, I can name very few who are still playing who I actually knew. You know, I think the last generation of players who I knew quite well were the Gerrard, sort of Beckham generation, the Lampard. And they've kind of all retired now. So there are very few left, actually, that I knew. So it's good. It's good fun. I'm in a position.
So you enjoy football again? Would you say you enjoy football? And
Kind of. I mean, like you said right at the beginning of this conversation, I never grew up following a club. I never supported a club, so I don't have that kind of like that beating heart. Right. That I care passionately every Saturday about how Arsenal are going to do. So I'm a bit more of a kind of smorgasbord. I quite like them. They're quite interesting.
Yes.
Also, you know, I really dislike them. So, like, there's a lot of teams the PSGs, the Man Cities of the world. I just like Man United. I've never forgiven them for being men. You know, I just like seeing them all get beaten a lot. So that's quite fun. And then the strange thing is that I sometimes find quite hard to justify to real football fans who have a real club that they support and they bleed for, is I actually find myself very heavily invested. And I wrote about this in the book that you listen to. I find myself very heavily invested in the fortunes of England, which is strange because I am not particularly nationalistic or patriotic. My politics don't really align with that kind of set of values necessarily.
Gotcha.
I'm quite a critic of our country in lots of ways. But there's something about the football team. There's something. Sorry, I've got a cat coming through.
Oh, no worries.
There's something about the football team that I just yearn for them to succeed and to get over the line and to win that major tournament that has eluded them since 1966. It's crazy, isn't it? And very particularly right now, I think in Gareth Southgate, they have a man of immense intelligence and dignity who culturally has moved that team of players on to represent something very different in the life of our nation. I know Gareth reasonably well, actually, because I used to work with him before he became a manager. He was working with us on TV. So I'm still in touch with Gareth. I have a lot of time for him, and I want him to succeed as a person because he's a good man.
Are you going to recommend for him to get rid of anyone like the way you got rid of Beckham, or
like the way I got rid of Beckham?
Are you going to try to stay out of this one?
Oh, I love that. I'm so glad you picked up on that. I was telling someone just the other day about that. piecing it all together is quite extraordinary. Yeah, I ended David Beckham's England career.
I think on Wikipedia it says when I went to Beckham's page, 2006.
Yeah, it was very funny that. I think it was, yeah. Well, you'd have to read the book to find out the details of that. But yes, I ended David Beckham. no, I mean, the funny thing about the current England team is that, here we go. Talking about players who are still playing from when I used to work in football. Well, one example of that is Harry Kane. So the last kind of couple of years of my broadcast work in football, Harry was a teenager and he was just coming through the ranks at Tottenham. And he'd been talked about at Tottenham ever since he was 15 or 16 years of age. You know, this kid is going to be great. And I, that particular year, and I can't, I would say off the top of my head, it was something like 2016 or something. He finally made his breakthrough and became a kind of first team regular at Tottenham. And kept scoring goals. I mean, he got his chances in the cups and in the Europa League and stuff like that. Not in the Premier League. He was not knocking on the door of the Premier League, but he kept scoring goals. And yet, I remember distinctly watching Tottenham train, and looking at Harry Kane, and I sort of nudged one of my co-presenters of the football broadcast. I won't name him. I won't name and shame him. But he said, I nudged him. I said, that Harry Kane kid. I mean, I don't understand the fuss. He just looks slow and cumbersome, and I think he's useless.
Call him Southgate right now. Tell him I'm not sold.
And this colleague of mine agreed. He said, "Yeah, I can't see. I don't know what the fuss is about Harry Kane." And you know, obviously, 8 years on, that sounds ridiculous because the guy has smashed every single record. But if you ask me now, I still don't understand Harry Kane.
Right.
There's something about him that just doesn't look good, and yet everything he does seems to work. It's mad. So yeah, my judgment is appalling.
All right, so you're not going to meddle. That's good. But I do agree with you that there's like I like international football more than I like club football.
That's good, but that's a rare thing, you know.
It's super rare. I can't none of my friends can. Like when it's international break, I get excited. I can tell you my reason though. I think my reason might be a little different. For me, actually, Serbia is against England in the Euro, so that's going to be a fun little matchup, maybe.
Oh, okay.
We can send each other some memes while the games are going. But for me, why I like the national team, even though they're an absolute mess and a disaster, it's like a Spanish soap opera for me to watch. It's the only place where I get to see the actual potential of what it would be like if the best players remained within the country.
Yeah,
so I get to a little peek into that window of what my dad had at Red Star. I get to see it at the national team level.
So I guess like 90% of the Serbian national squad play overseas, right?
Even more probably, even like 95. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a 600 million euro team, the national team. There is so much talent. I mean, they're an absolute they flop and they underperform for what the talent level they have is. But it's a there's potential there. I'm not going to ever see Red Star Belgrade get out of the group stages of Champions League probably in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But I could see them maybe make a little run, even though it might be delusional, a little run at a Euros or a little run at a World Cup.
Yeah, why not?
Like, it's exciting. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with you. I think it matters enormously. I mean, like, you will have picked up on the fact that Britain is quite a divided country. You know, things have not gone well over the last few years.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
And we're struggling. You know, as a culture, as a people, we're struggling. And I think there are very few things that can turn that tide and maybe make us feel a little bit more together and healed. And one of those things, one of those levers to pull is success for the England national team. Obviously, when I say Britain, the Scots and the Welsh would hate nothing more than seeing England succeed. That's a given. I totally accept that.
Okay.
But England, within the context of Britain, England is by far the biggest population. And I think, and England is full of division at the moment. But I think the success of this football team, it's just about the only thing that would bring us together a little bit. Like, I do not underestimate the power of this game. It's an amazing game, football, and it can do extraordinary things on it.
You know what's another thought that I had is, I think international football, the levels have gotten tighter. Everyone is, a lot of national teams are very close to even the bigger national teams. Like when you see upsets like, you know, North Macedonia against Italy or whatever, I think it's getting closer and closer at an international level. At a club level, it's getting as far as humanly possible, right? A billion-dollar Manchester City against a 60 million euro Red Star. That's never going to – like, that's just getting worse.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. Although I would say – I think possibly that's true within European football, within European nations. But what I find frustrating is the fact that with the exception of Brazil and Argentina – South America. You look at most South. Well, Uruguay are a decent team, aren't they? I don't know. It seems like that stayed pretty much a constant, South American football. And the real frustration for me is African football has not made the progress that was predicted of it 20-30 years ago, when you know everybody was saying that an African nation will win the World Cup soon. They're not, you know, well, actually, they're probably further away now than they've ever been.
Well,
almost,
we have to be brutally honest about what happens with African, players. They end up going somewhere to a European nation, citizenship there, or a lot of the best ones have come over and played in Europe and decided to play for European countries. I mean, I think that's the big thing that's going to hold them back until, they develop as a continent.
As an economy, yeah. So it's economy, the global inequalities are sort of reflected in that. And it seems,
I mean, look at Canada. Canada has a very solid football team now. I mean,
yeah?
Yeah, like they did pretty well. I mean, besides, they didn't have the results, but in their terms of play style, the talent they have, I think they did pretty good at the last World Cup.
Very good. Very good. I didn't know that.
Alfonso Davies from Bayern. I mean, they have a lot of talent.
Yeah.
There's another thing I wanted to ask you about the book, because to me it's really interesting when you're writing a book about yourself and what people know you for as the football commentator, and kind of deciding where to put the emphasis in terms of volume of stories. Like, how much do you want to make sure that you're appealing these people that only want to hear football stories, and how much do you want to talk about other stuff in your life and anecdotes and all that? How do you decide what to put in?
Yeah,
I mean, years of football, and you have so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a particularly unusual football book, actually, because because it describes falling out of love with football. You know, it's kind of like it's not a happy ending, particularly. I mean, there's a sort of resolution towards the end, but actually, it's a defeat. You know, ultimately,
what football fan is going to understand that? What football fan is going to feel relatability with that? Probably like 0.1%.
Yeah, but I'd put it slightly higher than that. I mean, I think I'm not alone in feeling this kind of like. I think a lot of people just kind of like have a residual relationship with football that's kind of like, because it's always been part of their lives, they just go along with it anyway and renew their season tickets and keep up their Sky Sports subscriptions and keep following it, almost as a sort of habit. But I think, there's a big cohort of people who would, if they were honest with themselves, I think would feel less engaged by the game now than perhaps, and maybe they're of a certain age. You know, it's all about aging, I think, as well. And this book is about aging to some extent. So you can't take that out of it. You're absolutely right. I mean, that balance between am I just being self-indulgent here? Does anyone care what happened behind the scenes before this match? Well, if that's the case, go and buy another book. Like I can only write one sort of book, and that's a book in the first person. And but I do think that there is a kind of like, and I've never totally understood why, because it used to be my working environment. So I take it totally at face value and it doesn't hold any mysteries to me anymore. But there is, generally speaking, a kind of like real appetite for sports fans who follow the sport through the medium of TV.
Right.
To kind of find out what happens behind the scenes. They're genuinely kind of interested in that, and they're sort of like, it's almost like the making of the movie. You know, how does it actually work when you're trying to keep? I'm pretty sure I wrote about it in the book. You're trying to keep Roy Keane and Gianfranco Zola happy in a canteen at the Allianz Arena, and you suddenly become aware that the two men have never met before or spoken to one another properly. And, you know, so the kind of encounters like that.
Or I think Romania trying to, you know, not say too much to the Romanian press, you know. Like,
that one, yeah. Then you're terrified that Alex Ferguson sitting in the hotel room next door to you is watching. Yeah. So like, I think it's quite relatable because we do feel like we know these people, you know. Like, I'm sure you feel like you know Roy Keane.
Sure. You know? I feel like I know personalities, especially when you listen to countless hours of them talking or giving their opinion of you. What happens in those conversations is a little bit of them gets dropped every single time.
Yeah.
In an hour of football talk, maybe it's a minute, maybe it's 2 minutes, but I get to see a little bit behind the you know, talking points and you know, today's story. Who cares how many goals Harry Kane? I don't care. He's going to score 3 next week. Who gives a shit? I get to see how they react and how they talk and what they're actually thinking a little bit.
Yeah, I actually think that the standard of sort of what we call punditry, you know, the ex-players who come in to give their expert analysis, I think in recent years it's really gone up, actually. I think that's been a big difference in my time in football because when I first started out, it was enough really for ex-players just to turn up and just go through the motions. And that's why we have all these very funny kind of like memes and like nostalgia for the cliches of the game. You know, it's not to say that they don't talk in cliches now, but a generation ago, it really was just a string of cliches. There was very little actual analysis. And it used to kind of frustrate me because I used to work with a player called Robbie Earle. He used to be the captain of Wimbledon and stuff. I believe he still works in America, actually, for one of the networks out there. But I used to sit pitch side with Robbie, watching Champions League matches, not commentating, but just watching it with him. And at half time, we used to jump on the pitch and do a bit of analysis together and then jump off again. But like off camera, off microphone, Robbie would sit there next to me and talk to me about the way that Milan was set up defensively and what the fullbacks and exactly what the fullbacks were doing, you know, like really kind of like. And I was like, oh my God, it's so much more actually nuanced and detailed than I ever understood. You know, like this game is super technical and complicated, actually. And I didn't know this. So I used to hang on Robbie's every word. I used to say to Robbie, listen, when we do our bit at halftime, tell the viewers that. The stuff you've just been telling me, tell the viewers that. Raise the bar a little bit. Like, let's bring this game to life properly. And for whatever reason, like as soon as the actual light went on the camera and we were there, Robbie would just kind of default back to making very simple statements that I think, generally speaking, in football, there is a fear amongst players, quite specifically players, that endures into their life when they stop playing. There is a fear of putting your head above the parapet and trying to look clever. Like, or trying to be a bit like too
tall. The tallest flower gets cut first, right?
You know, like it's easier just to be one of the boys and just go with the flow. And if the going with the flow means just don't try and over, you know, just like stop trying to make yourself look smart. I think that's particularly prevalent in football culture. But I think it's got less, you know, and I think it's really interesting.
Personality in the commentary now and in the people that analyze football.
Yeah, I think there is. I don't think it's changed for the better, you know. Roy's brilliant. Roy Keane is brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant.
This is a super random thought I just had. Actually, a few days ago, I was watching, you know, this is the beauty of the internet and memes and all that. Yeah. Someone sent me a indoor football, foosball league in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. And there's a Bosnian commentator that's commentating like there's no one watching. And it's utter brilliance. When I described to you what I heard, it was just like, this is amazing. Why isn't this guy like, I don't have a million subscribers on TikTok. So this is what happened. I remember that, like, it was like, I remember every word. So three ladies would sit in the crowd and he would say, well, I don't know why these three are here. Like, and he starts naming the players and he's like, that one's married. That one has a girlfriend. They're definitely not here to see me. I don't know what's going on here. Like, this is football.
I think there is a lot of space for that, you know, like it reminds me of the early days of Sky Sports when they used to have this, well, they had this feature, and they're going back 20, 25 years now, where I think it was called, what they called, the fan zone or something, where if you clicked a certain button on your remote control, you could opt out of the regular commentators and you could listen to two fans with microphones from opposing teams, you know, and it was like they dropped it after a while, but actually some of them were terrible, and it just showed you it just kind of like made the point very articulately of how difficult football commentary is and how actually it may look simple, but it's really, there's a lot going on. You know, there's a real art to it. But every now and again, they'd get two really funny characters in there who would be as random as that and basically replicating conversations that you'd have with your mates on the terrace.
Yes.
Which is like, which are some of the funniest conversations you're ever going to have, aren't you?
It's like, the best part of football, I would say, the watching it with friends aspect. I mean, is there a better feeling than a few beers with friends and watching football?
So I go, I support a club 2 miles away from me in South London now called Peckham Town. And they are, their average attendance is something like 200. It's £5 to get in, and you get a match day program and a raffle ticket as well. I sponsor the goalkeeper for an entire season. It cost me £50 to sponsor the goalkeeper. And they play in effectively the 11th division of English football, right? They're never going to get promoted, because if they get promoted to the 10th division, they have to have floodlights.
They don't have the budget for that, or what?
They haven't got the budget. So they even if they win the league like year after year after year, they're just going to stay in the 11th division.
There's a funny TV show.
But renewing my love affair with football, you know, rediscovering what I love about the game. I love going and watching Peckham Town play, and we have this tradition that, like, in the second half, we'll go and a few of us will stand right behind the opposition goalkeeper, right behind him, yeah. And there's this guy Andy who goes there, and Andy has a habit of finding out the goalkeeper's name, looking on his smartphone, and finding the goalkeeper's Facebook account, right? And then just reading out without comment, but just reading out verbatim like his most recent Facebook posts. It's the most off-putting thing. He's sitting there trying to do his job, and someone's just reading out your Facebook posts behind you.
I mean, my God, the only thing I can think of worse is like he gets his mom for a FaceTime or something, and he has to do a video call.
Oh, it's so funny though. It's great fun. It's great fun. Yeah,
that's absolute class. I think another thing is that people probably think about your job and all the crazy stories in the book, that, you know, your talks with Sir Alex or Mourinho. And a lot of the stories you do tell, and they probably romanticize, oh my God, he talked to Mourinho, he talked to Abramovich. Do you look at those stories and those moments with any real, you know, achievement or, you know, I don't know, pride? I don't know if the right word is there.
No, I'm not particularly proud of, I mean, yeah, from time to time I did some good work, but it wasn't often those kind of like flashpoints of, you know, in a live match interviewing these player. That was a hiding to nothing. There's very few ways of doing that really well, you know. The object there is just to get through without being decapitated. Like, this is tough stuff, you know, like in the pouring rain with Avram Grant after Chelsea have just thrown away the penalty shootout and he's lost the Champions League final and he knows he's going to be sacked. And it's 2 o'clock in the morning, local time. It's the deluge. And you've got a voice in your ear from your producer saying, ask him if he's going to be sacked.
You know, it's not really
it's like, you know, like, I'd rather be anywhere else. Beam me up, Scotty. Get me out of this situation. So no. But I mean, what I do acknowledge is that I was very privileged to be in those places at those points in time, you know, like I absolutely undisputably recognize how lucky I was, how fortunate I was to be there when Liverpool won the Champions League in Istanbul against Milan, that comeback, you know, etc. It was you know, Wigan winning the FA Cup, beating Arsenal. You know, there were things there that I kind of like. Sometimes I have to rub my eyes in disbelief and go, "Yeah, wow, I was there." You know, and like reluctantly, I would have to accept as well that time you alluded to, where Abramovich arrived at Stamford Bridge in, I think, 2004, and within a year he got rid of Claudio Ranieri and he brought Mourinho in. And like, it was, I don't know how old you were then, Nelly, but if you can have any memory of that time, it was incredibly exciting. It was glamorous in a way that, like Mourinho was just a superstar, wasn't he? You know, and so it was kind of like, it was quite thrilling to be week in, week out, dealing with Jose Mourinho, as difficult as he was, it kept you on your toes. You know, it was
what is a memorable thing that you remember from that time with interviews or conversation? What stood out to you? Maybe it wasn't even a moment. Maybe it was what you learned about his personality or the way he works. Was there anything that really kind of maybe that people wouldn't know about?
Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Like, he was always, his nickname, the Special One, for example, came about because I think his English is good, but it's not amazing for a man who prides himself on being a linguist. And I think I remember that first press conference when he first arrived, and he said something like, I am not like any other football, just any other football manager. I am a special one. But I don't think he realized that what the word special means in English.
All right. Yeah.
You know, like, I think because you speak Spanish, yeah?
Yes.
And in Portuguese, it actually, the word special means kind of particular or separate or slightly
right.
different. It doesn't have this kind of sense of special, you know?
Right.
But once he'd found out that it actually became a brilliant nickname, he fully embraced it. But he was possibly the most arrogant man I've ever met.
Really?
Yeah, really, like, really. That's not like
breaking news.
but in such a fascinating way. He would go through all this classic kind of power play things with you, like you learned after a while that you didn't put your hand out to shake hands with Jose Mourinho because you risk just being left hanging, you know, like that, the hand wouldn't come back, you know. So he would do those things as well. Like, he'd be brought into these, you know, these interviews, by the way, are done in these tiny little broom cupboards, you know, little forgotten spaces in the bowels of the stadium where they put the boards up. You know, you would not believe what it looks like behind the scenes there. And Mourinho would be brought in by his press officers, and he'd do all those usual things of not looking at you at all. Not acknowledge. He knew my name. He never used it once. He knew my name, but he never would. He never would have used it. You know,
very dehumanizing.
Looks at the shoes. Looks at his shoes. Looks at the floor. Looks at everywhere. He'll look anywhere but at the guy who's about to ask him a question. But then, as soon as bang, you go live and the interview starts, he looks at you. Yeah. And then, as soon as it goes out again, it's like without even saying goodbye or a thing. You know, it's like, you don't exist. You're just a cog.
Like the Truman Show. It's like a simulated reality. It's like he's only on for the cameras. And then the cameras.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And then he would leave his like a medieval kind of king. You know, he would have his court like tagging along after him, like his fools and his courtiers. So there'd always be like Chelsea would have two or three press officers kind of like bobbing along after him, who would do his dirty work for him. You know. So they're the ones who then come to you afterwards and issue all the threats or ban you. You know, I got banned by Chelsea for some completely non-existent offense. And
my God,
yeah, it was some
gulag in Russia. These guys do not want any bad press coming out. Or
I know, and it's pathetic, isn't it? It's just a game. It's just 22. It's just 22 blokes and a pig's bladder on a field. You know, it's like, what is? How did it come to this?
Right.
How did it come to this? Where
the
human
money.
Behavior. Well, I guess that's it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But you did have a time where you did unravel the curtain. The one story that really stuck me from the book was the Wenger conversation.
Yeah.
You never really go into detail. Is that for you know, you said you had talked to him for 30 minutes. Was it because it was uneventful, or is it because you don't want to share?
No, I'm quite happy. I mean, well, I can't remember in great detail what we spoke about, but I do remember it was in Warsaw. Arsene was there to cover the Euros in 2012, just like I was. He was working for French television. I was working for British television. And we were both off duty. He wasn't, effectively, if you like, he wasn't the Arsenal manager. He was someone who I'd been dealing with off and on for over 10 years. And it's the first and only time he ever used my name, right? Because he acknowledged the difference of the moments. And he said, hello, Ned. And we had a beer together. And we sat down and we spoke about the history of Warsaw in the Second World War, the Warsaw Ghetto. We spoke about the reconstruction of Warsaw and the style of architecture in this square that we were sitting in. All these kind of things that, you know, that. And then we spoke about cycling because he's
really?
Yeah, because he's big into his Tour de France. He follows the sport very closely. In fact, he turned up at the Tour de France last year. which was great. So he wanted to know whether Bradley Wiggins was going to win the Tour de France that year, and we spoke about that for a bit. So I do remember the conversation. But then it was like, you know, but he was quite a special man, Arsene Wenger. Still is. He was quite a special manager. But he held everybody kind of, it was kind of the opposite of Mourinho, because he held everyone in a mutual, an undifferentiated kind of position of respect. He had a certain respect for the job that you were doing, and treated everybody with a degree of equanimity, and didn't have his favourites, and didn't have his never banned people. He wasn't, didn't do that sort of stuff. Whereas Mourinho was very different.
Mourinho just didn't care.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, I would be criminal not to talk about cycling a little bit.
Don't feel you have to.
No. Actually, I also read the book, 1923?
Oh, yeah.
Mystery story. I guess, how many years have you been doing cycling commentary now?
I started at the Tour de France in 2003. So if you add it all up, I think I've covered the Tour de France 21 times. And bearing in mind, like, it's a month long. It's 3.5 weeks. So that's almost, what is it? It's getting on for 2 years of my life almost, like, at the Tour de France, if you add it all up, which is quite a chunk of time. Yeah.
Here's an interesting question. How does it feel to be 20 years in this sport commentary versus 20 years in the previous career path that you football?
Yeah, very different. I mean, they're culturally so different sports, and I have lost none of my enthusiasm or passion for the Tour de France. In fact, it's only deepened and thickened, and wow. So I have I'm still live and breathe it, actually, and unlike football, where if you grew up in Britain, not sure about Canada, can't speak for Canada, but if you grew up in Britain, or indeed Serbia, you kind of get football as a birthright. You know, like, you can't avoid it. It's like football. Everyone knows. Everyone's played football. Everyone knows about football, right? Everyone knows what the rules of football are. Whereas cycling is incredibly hard to understand, especially if you're from a non-cycling country, which Britain kind of was and kind of is. And so it took me 6 or 7 years to even feel remotely kind of qualified or kind of competent in talking about cycling.
Syndrome almost, right?
Totally. And so I think that I'm so
even
relieved.
With your pedigree in commentary, you would still feel that you as
I kind of knew how to ask a question and I knew how to phrase it, you know, like, but I didn't really feel I understood it for a long time. But then having achieved that, it's very rewarding. It's like cracking a code and then like, yes, now I get it. And it kind of like, because you've invested so much in actually trying to understand it, when you do understand it, it pays you back in dividends. Whereas football is just there for all to see, isn't it? It's just that's it, you know? It's a secret world. It's a secret world, cycling. And it's tiny compared to football. Absolutely.
Really?
Tiny. Yeah. Except, of course, the Tour de France is a grandiose adventure. You know, you just need to think about what it looks like in the month of July with 100,000 people on the side of a mountain. And, you know, it's kind of, so it's simultaneously massive, but also very amateur and very small.
Are you worried? Well, probably won't happen in your lifetime, but about the money and the interest growing in the sport and then turning into something like football, or is that too distant, or is that just not the way the sport is structured?
I just don't think it'll, I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Like, the top riders of the Tour de France for 100 years and more have been very, very well paid. You know, like, the top riders, and there's a lot of them are earning millions and millions a year. But that's kind of, that's it. There's never going to be any kind of European Super League. There's never going to be any, you know, it is what it is. And it's incredibly hard for the organizers and the people, like, effectively the equivalent of the Premier League, the people who own the competition. Yeah. It's incredibly hard for them to make money on the scale that, you know, they can sell the TV rights for whatever they're worth, but it's nothing like what football rights are. I mean, nothing like what football rights are worth. But the real problem they have, if you think about it, is there's no tickets. You can't sell tickets.
Right. Sell 300 miles of
Exactly. Land. Barrier off 250 kilometers.
Right.
Of, like, with turnstiles. Good luck with that. Yeah, ain't gonna happen. So there's no revenue, really. it's crazy. So the whole thing is, you know, it's a financial basket case. Whereas football is just a license to print money, isn't it? I mean, as the Glazer family at Manchester United have found out, you know, they've cracked it. Everybody disparages and despises the Glazers, but they do not give us stuff, because they figured it out long before anyone else did. You know,
The thing that's really weird about football is that there's, for the bigger clubs, the chance of getting relegated is close to 0%.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real big problem. I think you should be punished for 10 years of poor management. You should be. I'm not saying this as a vindictive way for the thing. I'm just saying in a fair perspective in terms of the sport's history. That's how it's always been. If you look at like the Nottingham Forest, you know, they've been down for many years because of poor results. Like, that's the risk of the sport. And to be bad every year and continuously get rewarded in terms of finances and new talent, it doesn't make any sense.
I completely agree with you. But, you know, you will, just by saying that, you will have made fans of certain clubs furious, you know, like, because they're so tribal. It's pathetic, isn't it? Like, you know, Newcastle United, that's a good case in point. A club for which I used to have a great deal of affection. Yeah. They're owned by Saudi Arabia, which beheads people. And murders journalists. I mean, it's just like, and yet the fans.
I should have told you we were sponsored by the Saudi oil company. we have to edit that one out.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. it's a murky world. It's a murky world. Anyway,
is that the bigger difference, I guess, then between cycling and football, and why there's hostility with these interviews and this level of seriousness? Is that not common in cycling? Is there not this level of toxicity, I guess, in your job and in the sport?
I think that's right, and it's just a question of scale. I think, you know, I think that and culturally, I think that the riders who go off and make their living as a, you know, in this very, very hard sport, are quite interesting people. They've got a lot to say for themselves. They spend a lot of time with their, because of the nature of the sport that they do, they spend a lot of time alone and alone with their thoughts and in their heads. And they often, in the English speaking world, Lance Armstrong included, you know, they have to uproot themselves and go off and live and work in a cup, like exactly like you've done in Valencia. They have to experience other cultures and learn languages that, you know, that's not common to English speaking footballers who kind of like, you know, so they're kind of quite interesting people. And, It's a very different culture.
Have you dabbled in triathletes?
No. I mean, I know it kind of, it doesn't, for me, triathlon at the moment, I'll probably alienate a lot of people by saying this. They're kind of like,
okay, so Saudi oil going to be pretty hot.
Triathlon seems like a quite good thing to do if you like suffering and like,
right.
But it doesn't make good television, I don't think.
No, 8 hours of I don't know. Some people like it. I guess it's a growing sport as well. I've actually had triathletes, and I have tremendous admiration for just the physical ability to put your body through what they do.
But admiration's one thing, and like, but actually the thrill of a contest is
thrill
what
of
you
it,
need. You know, like, you know, you need a head to head battle rather than just one guy who's faster than everyone else just running off.
But is the Tour of France like head to head interesting? Is it exciting?
Not always. Always. No, and certainly not exciting at every moment. No, you have to invest in a great deal of, you have to have a lot of patience, and you know, understand that the drama of the moment builds very slowly throughout hours. But then when it comes, the dramatic moment, it's all the more dramatic because you've anticipated it for so long.
Sure.
It's a completely different rhythm from any other sport, you know, and that's one of its complexities. And to be fair, it's one of the problems, you know, it alienates a lot of people that, and some people just never get beyond that and give up on it. So it's always going to be a relatively minor sport in that sense.
Is that your next book? Is then your next book going to be on cycling, or are you going to be dabbling in, I don't know, MMA fighting or something else?
No, I did try and write a book about MMA
while
ago. Yeah, a little bit, but I didn't, it never got off the ground. I wanted to write a book about what is sport. What actually makes a sport, and what sports are sports that you wouldn't think were sports, and what sports that you think are sports actually aren't sports.
And how many people are you going to piss off with this?
But the point I was trying to make about MMA was like, boxing and MMA actually aren't sports, because almost every other sport, I mean, they're incredibly skillful and incredibly, you need a lot of physical prowess and, you know, and all that sort of thing. But almost every other sport is a metaphor for combat, is a metaphor for like, you think of football, it's two armies, it's a territory thing, and most, you know, most games work along those lines. Boxing and MMA are combat. They're not a metaphor right. for anything. They're just a fight, right? That's not sport. That's a fight.
Never thought of it that way.
So, anyway, you can see why the book never got off the ground.
You're trying to pitch it to a publisher?
Yeah. It's gone.
I'm excited to whatever you do next. I really enjoy this conversation. I don't want to keep you any longer. I hope you do come back, though. I hope if you do finish another book, I'd love to chat again.
Cheers, Nelly. Thank you very much.
Thanks again for your time. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Say hello to Valencia. And get me Bilal to send me one of those.
I'm going to send him a message immediately.
Okay. Cheers, man. See you.